I took the course a couple of years ago, so it's recorded, it's on Pearson. If I manage to confuse you, you can go back to that lecture that Achim gave. Hopefully it's not going to happen, hopefully it's going to be clear, but please feel free to like stop me or ask me, etc. So the lecture is about integration today. So we will define integration over a general manifold, what it means to integrate over a manifold. So we will need several ingredients for that, but the most important ingredient we need is differential forms. Actually, I think that's the very reason why we bother introducing them at the first place. They help us define integration over a manifold. So you might ask, what is special about differential forms that is totally antisymmetric covariant tensors? So the answer is that exactly because they're antisymmetric, they have some special transformation properties under charge changes. We know, for example, that when we integrate over Rn and we want to change coordinates, we pick up this factor, which is just a determinant of the Jacobian of the transformation matrix. As we will see in the lecture, it's exactly these special transformation properties of the differential forms that in some sense compensate for these factors that we pick up under changes of coordinates, which will help us to define integration in a chart independent, or let's say coordinate independent way, abstractly. So that's good, but there is just something we have to keep track of. We need the notion of orientation that is defined basically with respect to the sign of this determinant of the Jacobian matrix. This is just to say that when we have to patch different charts with each other, sometimes we have to keep track of signs to make sure we integrate properly. And so we need an abstract notion of orientation for a manifold that will help us keep track of like what's going on about that. So let's define what is an orientation for a general manifold, because we will use it to define integration properly. Okay, so let's start with a simple example, which is just a one-dimensional manifold. Here it is. And we have a chart, which is basically just a map from the one-dimensional manifold to R, just to R, because it's one-dimensional manifold. So imagine that the chart is such that this point is mapped here and the other point is mapped there in the end of the interval. But then imagine we have another chart that actually maps these points, the endpoints, the other way around, and just does something in between so that we have the same image. And should this matter when we want to integrate over this manifold? Should this make any difference? Should it depend on what chart we choose to integrate over the manifold? We know, for example, just from usual integration over R, let's say functions over R, real functions, that, for example, if we flip the limits of integration, we pick up a minus sign. And this is fine as long as we keep track of the signs, or we can just have some, like, fix the chart and have some notion of orientation, stick with it, and then integrate properly throughout the manifold. So how do we define this? We know that for n-dimensional manifolds in general, we may need several charts to cover them, right? In the one-dimensional example, I just gave you an example of, okay, one chart does this, and the other chart just does the other way around. In general, we might need several charts to map to R1, R something. So if we have a collection of charts, which is what we call an atlas, we call this atlas oriented if among all overlapping charts, so the charts in general can overlap, right? That's why we need a lot of them to actually, in some sense, patch the manifold and map the whole thing in Rn. So this collection of charts, this atlas, is called oriented if among all the overlapping charts with coordinates, let's say one chart is mapping us to coordinates x and the other chart is mapping in coordinates x tilde. So if the determinant, of this transformation matrix from X to X tilde is positive, this is called an oriented atlas. So if a manifold possesses such an atlas, if we can find such an atlas on the manifold, an oriented atlas, this is when the manifold is called orientable. Yes, so for example, this is an example of a not orientable one. Now, a manifold together with such an oriented atlas is called an oriented manifold. So that's good because it actually sets the standards of what is like orientation on the manifold. Because, okay, you can find one oriented atlas, but you can define other atlases. You can take an arbitrary chart, and then you can say that this is positive or negative, depending on what is the Jacobian of that, the overlap of this arbitrary chart with the chart of the oriented atlas. And then this gives us some kind of reference, some notion of saying what's going on with these signs. So in principle, you could use other charts to integrate over the manifold, but you would have to keep track of all these. So this is why it's better to actually make use of an oriented atlas, if you can have one, to integrate over the manifold. We will see this in the definition. We haven't even defined integration yet. Okay, so we have a notion of orientation. What else do we need to define integration over the manifold? We need a notion of a volume form. So a volume form is just an N form. It's an element of lambda N, is what is called a top form. Because remember that for an N-dimensional manifold, there is no n plus 1 forms, so the Grassmann algebra ends there, because n plus 1 differential forms, trivially, there's zero. So it's a top form, and it's called a volume form if it nowhere vanishes. So that's just the only requirement that would turn an element of lambda n into a volume form. So keep in mind, that's what this little comment here is about, that we can have this on a manifold. We will actually use this to define integration without any notion of distance, without any notion of a metric. So later on, like you will see in general relativity, that the most natural or like the choice we usually make for this volume form actually depends on the metric, which sounds like a natural thing because our notion of a volume, maybe we want to associate it with our notion of a distance. But it's just not necessarily the case. So you see that we can have this structure on a manifold without introducing a metric yet. All that is this. You haven't introduced a metric yet in the course, but still we can define integration without it. So just as a side comment. So now how are these two different ingredients, orientability and volume form, related to each other? So there's actually a proposition that if the manifold possesses a volume form, it is orientable. So it's actually an infinite leaf. And that's interesting, that orientability allows you to actually define such a volume form. And then if you have a volume form, you can find such an atlas for the manifold, it's orientable. Okay. So, to define integration, let us first look at our usual, more familiar case of how we integrate in Rn. So, if we have, just in Rn, a change of coordinates from x to x tilde, and we're integrating over a function g of x1, xn, dx1, dxn, just in the usual Riemann or Lebesgue integration kind of sense. We know that if we change coordinates from here to the tilted ones, we know that we will pick up this determinant of the Jacobian matrix of the coordinate transformation. So we write the function was g of x, right? When the coordinates were the first ones. Then we go to x tilde. So we actually want to write down the same function, but just, well, okay. I guess that's fine. So, or should I close it? Are you sure? Yes. Click here to change. Okay. I close it. Let's see what happens. Okay. So we had g of x. Now we want to integrate with respect to the new coordinates. So we need to write x as a function of x tilde. So it's basically like using the inverse of that coordinate transformation, but it's basically the same function. We are just integrating with respect to different coordinates. So this is the integration with respect to these different coordinates, but it's not just the function here anymore. We pick up this extra factor is the determinant of the Jacobian matrix. So this is just to keep in mind how that works in Rn, right? Because we know that once we have a suitable notion for a manifold, we can use the charts to go back to Rn, and then we know how things look like there. So keep this in mind when we actually, okay, now it's not working, you see? It's not going down. Okay, yes, makes sense. Okay, so keep this in mind, because that's why there's this star there, because we will compare with the transformation properties of the differential form, the n form. Because as I was trying to sketch in the beginning, we need differential forms. Differential forms are suitable for integration, for defining integration abstractly, not in Rn, but in any manifold, exactly because somehow we will see this coming up when we will explicitly check how that object transforms under chart changes. So let's do this. Here is an n form. It's an element of lambda n, right? So just the coefficient function, and then dx1 wedge dx2 wedge dxn, the basis element of lambda n and the coefficient function. Remember from previously that lambda n is just a one-dimensional space. So it's really all we need to define an element in there, just one coefficient, and this is the basis element of that space. Let's see how that transforms if we change chart. Okay. Actually, maybe it's better if you can see them both, kind of. Yes. Okay, so now we have the function f of x, but again, we have to write it as f of x as a function of x tilde. And then all this dx1, dx2, dxn will actually become the tilded version with I1, I2, in, summed over with all these factors that we pick up when we're going from, so dx1 is just this along with that, right? Even just from the physicist definition of what it means to do this transformation, remember that the one forms pick up this function. It's just the partial derivative of x1 with respect to x tilde, summed over, right? This is summation. This is another summation, and this is another summation. All possible sums over the x1, xn, with respect to x tilde 1, x tilde n, right? So the thing is that here, if we sum, if we explicitly write down what the sum stands for, here we would have I1, I2, In having all possible values from 1 to n, all of them. So for example, one of these terms would look like here would be 1, 2, and then I don't know, 10. Let's say we're in a 10-dimensional manifold. Then it would be like 1, 10, 5, 4, blah, blah, and then 1, 3, 3. So they would also repeat, right? You might have like five times and all that, but we know that from antisymmetric property, these indices cannot repeat because it's zero. So basically, there's not much surviving this summation. Whenever the indices repeat, it's zero. So what we're left with is only the terms in which I1, I2, IN have different values from 1 to n. All possible permutations, actually. But we know that we can just shuffle things around for these terms, just suitably putting minus signs when we do this. And then we're really just left with just one term, the one that really orders from 1 to n. And if you really keep track of what happens, which terms survive here, once you do this, it just turns out to be the determinant of the Jacobian matrix. So that's what's cool about that. You can actually like explicitly check by yourselves. But I hope it's clear at some kind of like basic level why we actually just end up with this one term, and then just believe me that all these surviving terms will actually give you just the determinant of the transformation matrix. So let's now compare this formula with what we have in Rn, right? The thing I showed you before, just this. Like this here is exactly that new coefficient in the new basis of lambda n once we change chart. So that's nice. And that's why we will use this to define integration in a chart independent, that is well defined, way over the manifold. So, okay, at last we have the definition here. So, assume we have a manifold that is oriented in the sense that we discussed before, n dimensional, and we have an n form, omega, that in a chart reads like this. So we will define what it means to actually integrate this n form over the manifold. We really define this through what this looks like in Rn. So you pick a chart, that's the chart here. So from the manifold to whatever the image of the manifold is in Rn. And then you say that I'm integrating just these coefficient functions over dx1, dx2, dxn in the usual Riemann or Lebesgue integral kind of way. So that's nice, because what is nice about this is that, okay, that's like the abstract definition over a manifold, but we define it through concretely through Rn by using a chart. So you might think that, okay, I've used a chart to define this. But exactly of what we were discussing before, this definition ends up being chart independent. So if, for example, you do the same integration of that one form, just using another chart here, like you take a different image of the manifold, of course, it will not look like this in the chart, you will have the factors and all that, but just because this matches the transformation property of omega, this definition ends up being chart independent, so you would get the same number. So, okay, this is, as it says here, if one chart suffices. So I keep talking about one chart. But most commonly, we have several charts. And in some sense, we might have to patch them to actually do this. And this is exactly when orientation becomes important. If you stick to an oriented atlas, it's just easier to keep track of what's going on once you patch things together. Is this clear? Okay. Now that we know how to integrate, what comes next is actually Stokes' theorem, written in these abstract terms. But to do this, first we need some extra ingredients. For example, we need to know what is a boundary operator. Okay. Oh, okay. Actually, one last thing is that with this definition, see here, this says that you can integrate an n form, omega is an n form, right, over an n-dimensional manifold. But this also holds for submanifolds. So if I take like, I don't know, R dimensional submanifold of M, then I can integrate R forms over that one. So it's just that always the like the order, how do you say, of the form, like what is like N form, R form, or like phi form, whatever, this should match the dimension of the manifold here. So we define it for the whole manifold, but you can actually integrate over submanifolds as long as you integrate the corresponding like form. Like a three form, you integrate over a three-dimensional manifold, a two form over a two-dimensional submanifold, and so on. That's about how to integrate over subregions. So, okay, and then we'll have this so-called boundary operator floating around, which is that once we have a region of a manifold, of an n-dimensional manifold, what this operator does is actually that it's mapping you from the region to its boundary. And what it means for this boundary to be smooth, we actually define through the image of the boundary through a chart. So if the image of the boundary, here's just the abstract manifold, that's the region, that's the boundary of the region, and we can visualize it through a chart. And if the it's like, let's say, an n minus one dimensional plane in the chart or something like this, we would say that the boundary is smooth. So we define smoothness of the boundary through the chart that covers the boundary. So yeah, it's just a geometrical object that takes you from a manifold to the boundary, a manifold of dimension that is like smaller, like one dimension smaller. So what is another like nice proposition about this is that if the manifold you start from, the big manifold, is orientable, then so is the region. So in some sense, these regions inherit the orientability of the manifold. And this induces an orientation for the boundary. We are saying all this just because in the context of Stokes' theorem, we will find ourselves wanting to integrate over boundaries. But to actually integrate over boundaries, we need to care about, but wait, are they orientable or not, you know? So this guarantees that if the manifold you start from is orientable, then the region is orientable, then the boundary of the region is orientable. So you can be comfortable integrating over either of those. Okay, and here is Stokes' theorem. We have all the ingredients for one of math's most important theorems. Actually, Achim said it's one of his favorite theorems. So let's say we have n-dimensional region, and we want to integrate over that region d omega, an n form. Then Stokes' theorem says that this is equal to integrating just omega, not d omega, but just omega, over what? Over the boundary of that region. So an easy way to memorize this theorem is literally to think of d as becoming like a del down there, because it's basically this thing. So we have an n-dimensional integration in some sense, this n-form over n-dimensional region, and then omega is in lambda n minus one, right? This makes sense because for this integration to make sense, the region, that's the boundary of the region. If this, just to do the counting to see that things are like matching here. So if that was an n-dimensional region, this is an n minus one dimensional thing. So the only thing you can integrate over this is an n minus one form. So it makes sense. So what this theorem does is basically it's connecting in a very deep way differentiation with integration, if you want, because it says instead of integrating d omega over the region, you can as well integrate omega itself on the boundary. Exactly, because this kind of seems to say that this is in some sense dual or like cooperator of this. Sometimes the D, the exterior derivative that you introduced previously, is called the co-boundary operator. That's the boundary operator, the del, and that's sometimes called the co-boundary operator for this reason. Okay, so that's what Stokes' theorem looks like abstractly. And what we will do for the rest is that we will see special cases in different dimensions, and we will actually end up taking very familiar things from physics or from math, like calculus. And, but before we do that, let's just try to iterate Stokes, because it would be nice, like it's kind of like inviting you to iterate it in the sense that you, by using this theorem, you end up with an integration that is one dimension less. Maybe it's like easier to integrate over the matter or something like this. So what if you keep doing this and you in somehow you reduce this to an easier and easier problem or something? But turns out that it's actually trivial. If you try to do this, to iterate Stokes' theorem, you end up with something like 0 equals 0. And to see why that is, imagine that you want to integrate the d of d omega over a region. Then what the theorem says is that, okay, like one of the d's, you can put it down there, take the boundary of that region, the del, and then just integrate d omega, right? We already know that just looking at that, this should be 0, because you saw previously that d of d is actually 0. So for algebraic reasons, we know that this has to cancel out. But nevertheless, through the theorem, it equals this. Then this, we can just do Stokes' theorem again and take that d down here. And then we're integrating just omega. And then we have the boundary of the boundary of the thing. So del square is also 0 because there's boundaries don't have boundaries in some sense. So it's for geometrical reasons. That del square is also 0. So it's consistent. We take through doing Stokes twice, we just take that 0 is 0 for different reasons. And that's why here the comment says that it's connecting geometric aspects to algebraic ones. It's consistent, but like, yeah, it's actually quite a curious thing that this is region, this is 0 because boundaries don't have boundaries, but that was just, as you saw before, just algebraically, just generally true that d of d is cancels. Okay, that's just a funny thing about Stokes' theorem, to familiarize yourself with how you actually switch d's into dels. And so the first special case of Stokes' theorem is just the manifold being one-dimensional, the manifold just being R itself, and the region is just an interval, an open interval. So what is the boundary of the interval? It just consists of two points, A and B. And through Stokes' theorem, if we want to integrate a function, df, over that interval, we know we have this. So we can easily see that this basically gives us the fundamental theorem of calculus in this special case, because that's just this here, df dx, the x integration with respect to x. And this means that you actually have to evaluate in the endpoints and subtract, which is the fundamental theorem of calculus. It's kind of nice. So that's just in R. Then we can try Stokes' theorem in R2 and see what we get in R2. So we will actually get Green's theorem as a special case. If you've done physics and you electromagnetism and all this, you've seen Green's theorem a lot. So we will take it as a special case in two dimensions. So if the manifold is just R2 and G is it's a region with a closed boundary that's like D del G. So what do we have to do is consider an arbitrary one-form. So it's in lambda 1 and 1-form. It looks like this, right? So that's the two basis elements and the two coefficients. So if that's the one-form, what is the d of it, d omega. Remember, you can use d as a derivation. You can use the Leibniz rule. So how do we do this? We just, so yeah, no, this is, so first d acts on this, and we have like just the d of a function, right? That's just a function, it's a coefficient function. Where's dx1? You would have another term for here, which would be that the d acts on dx1. But these terms are not there because d on d is zero, right? So this is just not there. So from doing Leibniz rule in this one, only that survives, the d on the coefficient function. Same here. So d omega 2 dx wedge dx2, but then d of dx2 is not there because it's zero. OK, that's that. Then for each of these terms, we take two terms because you see we have the partial derivative over dx1 and the partial derivative of omega 1 with respect to 2 over dx2. That's for this term, and then this here is for that term. So dx2 here and d omega 2 is just this, right? Because omega 2 is just a function, lambda 0, so the d of this lives in lambda 1. It's in one form, and that's a general one form. The coefficients given by the partial derivatives, right? Okay, so these two combine, like the final thing is just because you see some of the terms are, in, are then you end up with dx1 wedge dx1, which is zero, dx2 wedge dx2, which is zero, because the wedge is antisymmetric. The indices cannot repeat. So you only end up with dx1 dx2 and dx2 wedge dx1. Then you can just flip once more, you pick up a minus sign. So yeah, just see this, that just flip this, just one basis element with this coefficient. Just the one minus the other. This starts looking like a curl or something. So that's what the coefficient looks like for this reason. So okay, that's what d omega is. Let's apply Stokes' theorem because we know how to integrate d omega through Stokes' theorem. So the Stokes' theorem says that if you integrate d omega, if you integrate this over the region, you can as well integrate omega, which was just this, over the boundary. And that's how we take Green's theorem as a special case in two dimensions. But it might take a little bit of more like work to see what this really means, like the right-hand side. Because you need like a, so if we are in two dimensions, right? So the boundary is one-dimensional. So what you can do to actually calculate this concretely is to find a curve that actually parameterizes the boundary. So if we have this map from R to the boundary, this defines a curve, and we can actually then reduce this to usual like integral over that real parameter R, but parameterizing the boundary of the two-dimensional region, the one-dimensional boundary. Okay, I hope this makes sense. That was in two dimensions. Then a special case of that, of Green's theorem, would be if actually omega was a closed form. So we know that when omega is a closed form, this means that d omega is zero. When we say d omega is zero, that's this relation for the coefficient function. So from Stokes' theorem, if this would mean that this is zero, right? Because we integrate d omega over g is equal to integrating omega over del g, and this would have to cancel. And another thing that we see in electromagnetics where the potential is such that integrating over the boundary, we take zero. So another thing that we can compare with, another like curious thing, is how that connects to the residue theorem in complex analysis. So we have, in complex analysis, we have like a function from C to C. And we say that it's holomorphic when this integral over the boundary is zero. So we know that, if you remember from complex analysis, when a function is holomorphic, and so that's zero here, this means this looks like the Cauchy-Riemann equation. So we just take this from the holomorphicity of the function. But you might notice that that's just the comment, that you take only one of the Cauchy-Riemann equations, just because like this gives only this closeness of omega. The omega is zero, gives just only this one equation. To take the full Cauchy-Riemann equations, we would actually have to define something else that is called co-closed. So it doesn't suffice that it's closed, it has to be also co-closed. But you will define this later on in the course. Just to say that already just closeness through Stokes' theorem, we can compare it with like Cauchy-Riemann in the complex plane. Okay, enough with two dimensions, then it's three dimensions. So we're gonna see what this actually, that's an exercise for you. So you just do this in three dimensions, and you will see, similar to the calculation I tried to explain before, that you will actually take the curl of a vector field on the left-hand side being equal to this integral over here, like the flow of the field on the boundary in three dimensions. So yes, I don't know what else to say about this. It's an exercise if you want to check explicitly that this will turn out to be Stokes' theorem in three dimensions. Yeah, as it says here, yeah, so this is the cross product. What we mean by this curl there is the cross product that just has these coefficients over here that will actually come up naturally once you will take the D of your form. You will see that the coefficients will look like this. That's a two-dimensional submanifold of the three-dimensional space. And here your boundary is going to be one-dimensional. So, indeed, remember that if omega is a one form, then d omega, so all we mean by this like curl symbol that's like very common in physics, all we mean by that is basically the d of that one form. And remember that lambda 2 is three-dimensional. So indeed, you take, once you calculate what that is, it's a three-dimensional space, so indeed you will have three components to specify this d omega. And it's just that the components with antisymmetry and all that, all these minuses, look like what we usually call the curl. But it's not a vector or anything just because it has three components. It's actually an element of lambda 2. So yeah, anyway, just keep track of where things live and what happens with the minus, and you will see that d omega actually the components of it looks like that. Okay. An exercise for the reader. Okay, so now, last and fourth example is the Gauss theorem. So we will see the Gauss theorem as a special case of Stokes' theorem. And for that, we need yet another element, which is a notion of volume, like to specify what we mean by volume, because this will give us a notion of divergence. Remember, Gauss' theorem is about divergence of a field in a volume of a region. So we need a notion of volume, and then what we mean by divergence. So, okay, how we define the volume of a region of a manifold? We know that in Rn, what we mean by volume is literally just the outcome of the integration of the coordinates that you choose over a region. So you have a region, and once you integrate, this number is usually what we think of as the volume. Or if it's like two-dimensional and you integrate, it's like the area. So in n dimensions, this integral is what we call the volume in Rn. So in general, for an n-dimensional manifold, we just have a volume form is an element of lambda n, we decide that this omega is not zero for all the points in the region. So if you have this and you integrate over the region, that's what you would call the volume of the region. So yes, it's an omega-dependent volume, and it's defined exactly like that. Because again, this makes sense. This is an N-form for an n-dimensional manifold, and this is our region. Again, keep in mind that that's a volume that has nothing to do with length, just directly a volume. You don't have a metric yet. You haven't introduced a metric. This is what will happen later in the course. The most natural way of talking about volumes of regions of spacetime would be through the metric, through the notion of length for the spacetime, but that's still not the case. Not the case yet. And it's just good to keep in mind that these are two separate choices, actually. Okay, and just another proposition is that if the region is orientable, then one can see that there is actually a volume form, and in fact, infinitely many. So it's like a real choice you have to make. Like, there's too many choices. But it's guaranteed through the orientability, back and forth. Okay, so with this notion of a volume, to see Gauss's theorem, we can define divergence. What is a divergence of a vector field? Yes, we need a new derivative that will be called the divergence of a vector field. So if you recall what we usually mean by divergence on Rn, it's just that if we have a vector field and we take the divergence of it, we literally sum up all the partial derivatives. So it's a vector field, so it has, let's say, n components, x1, x2, xn, and then dx1, dxi, okay. The thing is, so that's xi, I tend to say xi because I'm from Greece, but so, sorry for the confusion. So yeah, xi and x, so dx1, dx, dxi1, dx1, plus dxi2, dx2, and so on, sum them all together. This, like with a summation convention, it's what we call the divergence. So we know, at least from our intuition from Rn, what we expect this object, this operator to do to the vector field. But we want to write, to define this object with respect to other derivatives that you have introduced, like the Lie derivative that you introduced last class. And there is a clue here. How can we actually take this out of how the Lie derivative works? So if you remember, a general tensor, the Lie derivative of a general tensor with respect to xi, so we differentiate like a directional derivative with respect to xi for a general tensor tau. So like how this acts on the tensor, if you spell it out, had these partial derivatives of the components times the components of the vector, and then just the components, and then these derivatives just see the components of the vector field, and so on. So the exclamation mark here is just that's a clue that if we compare, so we want this, we kind of see this appearing here. So we can hope, like it's literally the partial derivative of the components of the vector field, as it's there from Rn. So that's what we want, and we just hope that for a particular choice of tau, the rest of the terms that we wouldn't want to have there would vanish. We will see how. And that's just a clue that, okay, we can actually define something that will work like a divergence through the Lie derivative, just by like getting rid of this, for example, and just somehow tau will be say one or whatever, and then we will sum up this or something. So Lie derivative gives a good clue for how to define divergence. So let's say that tau, for example, would be the volume form in Rn. So what is the volume form in Rn? It's just, the coefficient is just one, and then just dx1, wedge, dxn, etc. So because we know we just integrate over, in the chart, we just integrate over dx1, dxn to take the volume, right? So the coefficient is one here. And we know that if you differentiate one, it's a constant, you take zero. So in fact, at least in Rn, we know that this would work, the divergence of a vector field psi with respect to that volume can actually be defined through the Lie derivative of that volume form. Just to go back to what the clue was supposed to be about, with the coefficient of the volume form being one, you see that these derivations of the coefficients would just vanish. This would be just one. We will somehow end up summing up just all the partial derivatives of the coefficient functions of the vector field. Anyway, that just to motivate this definition, that's just a definition. It's a definition of what is a divergence. So a divergence of the vector field psi with respect to a volume form omega. This is why omega is down here. Like, you have to fix this choice to define divergence. It's just the Lie derivative, the directional derivative, like with respect to psi, of the volume form. That's the definition. Okay. Hope it's clear. Just keep this in mind, because now we will explicitly calculate for omega having this form. It's a volume form. That's a general coefficient function, A of x. That's just an n form. So okay, just choose this volume form, and for psi like these coefficients, right? So we just explicitly choose coefficients here to see concretely what the divergence looks like. Okay, so we have to take the Lie derivative of the volume form, right? So first, I have to go there again. So, okay, the Lie derivative of this, right? Again, the Lie derivative is a derivative, so it satisfies the Leibniz rule. So first, the Lie derivative has to act on what? Just the coefficient function, just the zero form, right? We just don't write the wedge here because it's just a function, so, but it's really a zero form. So I think last class you defined the action of the Lie derivative on a function, but just being the evaluation of like psi of A, psi of that function. And you know what that is? This is just this psi I dA dxi, right? So this came up just by acting the Lie derivative on the function. And the rest is just dx1, dxn. So the rest of the terms is just like, then the Lie derivative, once we evaluate it on the coefficient, the Lie derivative would have to see each one of these one forms, right? First dx1, then dx2, then dxn. This is all these terms where we just leave the coefficient outside, and the Lie derivative sees just one of these guys. Is this clear? Just Leibniz rule for the Lie derivative. It's important just to know how to actually calculate the divergence of a vector field, given that n form. Okay, now that's a little messy here, but we just need to know what that is, right? So we just need to know the Lie derivative on dxi. So remember from last class that, I think it was the last class that you defined the Lie derivative, right? That you actually have to define the action of the Lie derivative on functions and one forms. And then the rest, like let's say you want the Lie derivative of just a general tensor. It actually reduces to that through the Leibniz rule. So if you actually define by hand how it acts on zero forms and one forms, then you know how it acts on a general tensor, just because you will just do a Leibniz rule multiple times. So it's not really that you forgot or something, like that action on one form was just the starting point, the definition of what is this supposed to be. So let's calculate given what that is. So we have just the Lie derivative of an one form, right? And then that was defined to be the d of x of xi, oh my god, xi of xi. So, okay, how to put it? Yes, so you have the little derivative of the one form, and it's just the d, the differentiating the action of the of this vector field on this function, just the coordinate function, xi. So the thing inside xi of xi is just this, right? So summation, all the coefficients, and then partial derivatives of the coordinate functions with respect to the coordinates. So this will just give us the Kronecker delta, right? Because dxi, dxj, just give us delta ij. And that's just the coefficient here, and just the d. We didn't do anything to the d. So just because that's a delta, a Kronecker delta, then we're left only with xi, right? That's a, I'm not sure if you can even see, actually. Like, I'm pointing here, but like some of you are far away. So there's j and then ij. And so we're left only with I. So then it's just d of xi. D of xi, what is xi? Xi is a function. So it's a d of a function, the d of a zero form. And we know that this is a one form, and this is this one form, with coefficient functions being just the partial derivatives of xi with respect to x. If there's any question about these like steps, let me know. You can just also try yourselves later. So that, again, that was just a matter of definition, and the rest follows from how like the rest of the objects are supposed to be acting. So, okay, we have this bunch of terms here, but okay, that, remember, why are we doing all this? This was just that, right? So we were going for the divergence of xi with respect to the volume form. So yeah, just bear with me, and it's like this in the end, but we have to see how to get there. So it's just this term and then this summation, and we were just wondering what that is. And now we see that the lead derivative of dxi is actually this bunch of terms. So there is a lot of dxr here. R takes all the values from 1 to n, but I is a particular I that we started from here. We were going for the lead derivative of dxi. But now we have this bunch of terms here. But see, again, because of the wedge product, because of antisymmetry, most of these terms will go away. Because let's say I was 3 or something, and then the rest of the numbers would be not 3. But here you would have this repeating, so you would have to throw most of them away. It's not as bad as it looks. So what you end up having in the end is just that you would take dx1 wedge all the way to dxn, and the only surviving terms here, like the coefficient of that, is just these two terms. So the one term, remember this? So this just comes from that one, right? Not even this summation thing. That xi of alpha over there was exactly this. And then we're left just with this thing, just summing over the partial derivatives of the coefficients for the vector field. And that's all that we're left with from all this sum, all this mess here. So this one term. I mean, when I say one, I mean that's again summation, but it's just this. So this thing now, you can write just more compactly, like this. So the divergence looks like that. You have this, just the partial derivative outside the parentheses, because in fact, it's just gonna see once the coefficient and once the xi. And then there is just this 1 over alpha, because alpha times this was our volume form, right? So our volume form is alpha times this, and we divide with alpha so that it's basically the same. We just want the volume form to appear explicitly in this formula, because actually we define divergence with respect to it. So whatever alpha was, remember the volume form was just this. All you need to fix is actually alpha, a non-canceling, like a, let's say, positive function alpha. So this explicitly plays a role in what the divergence is, which makes sense. Again, if alpha, for example, was 1, you would literally just get what we wanted, right? Didn't we want just to sum the partial derivatives of the psi for the divergence? So if alpha was 1, for example, it would just directly be that, just as a special case. Later on in general relativity, you will actually associate alpha to the metric. So once you have a metric, this alpha will, I'm sure you've seen it if you've taken GR before, this square root of the determinant of G that appears all over the place, would actually, given the metric, it would be the alpha for the natural volume form of spacetime. But anyway, generally we just have this alpha floating around. And that's what the divergence looks like. Okay, yes, special case, if it was 1, just the usual thing, what I was just mumbling about. Okay, so we know what the divergence is, finally. And just to keep track of the counting here, we're almost done. We just want to write down the Gauss theorem, right? Yeah, we actually have time. So, okay, how do we write Gauss theorem now? So the divergence of a vector field defined through the Lie derivative actually lives in lambda n, right? Because remember, the Lie derivative goes from lambda n to lambda n. It's like this derivation of degree 0, if you want. Like, doesn't change you, like, it's the sectors of the Grassmann algebra, just, it's like, doesn't change. It's like from like one forms to one forms, so two forms to two forms, and so on. So the Lie derivative of an n form is again an n form, is in lambda n. So remember from previous class, I think, that you wrote the Lie derivative in this way. You derived that we can write the Lie derivative, actually I think it was definition of the Lie derivative, that it would be this combination of exterior and interior, oh no, how do you call Jotax xi? Interior, inner derivation,
inner.
Inner derivation, yes. So one is like x, yes, so that was degree 1 minus 1, and this combination of this exterior and inner derivation was actually, this whole thing is the Lie derivative. So, but look now that omega is an n form, and most commonly the volume form, but just generally any n form. If you act with D on an n form, it just cancels out, because n form is a top form. There is no n plus 1 forms for an n-dimensional manifold. So D of an n form just drops out. So when we act the Lie derivative in particular on an n form, only this term survives, and we have this here. So the divergence has a simpler formula then. It's just the D of the inner derivation of the volume form. Okay. And now that we end up with a D of something, we can actually apply Stokes' theorem. That's all we wanted. Like writing divergence as a D of something, we can actually apply the theorem that we stated in the beginning today, that integrating D of something is the same as integrating this something over the boundary. So that's what we're gonna do now. I mean, it's just this. So, yes, what do we have? We have the integral of D of the inner derivation of omega. And then from Stokes' theorem, the D just becomes the del of G. So it's just as we integrate this over the boundary, right? So, and that's exactly what Gauss' theorem is about. So we have the integral of the divergence over the region. because remember, that's what this was, right? From here. So the divergence is this. The integral of the divergence is exactly the integration of that in the, on the boundary. That's Gauss' theorem, if you remember from electromagnetics, you have like charges and they generate an electric field. And then you say how the electric field diverges in the volume. Actually is given by the flow of that electric field on the boundary kind of thing. And it's actually a curious thing, it's interesting that Gauss' theorem we just saw as a special case of Stokes. Usually, at least in, I don't know, undergraduate electromagnetism classes, we see them separately. We think it's Stokes' theorem and Gauss' theorem. But structurally, this is really just a special case, which is kind of cool. So just last thing before we finish, actually quite early. yeah, that's the last slide. It's just to make sure that we understand like how counting works here. Because, okay, what was that? That was an N form. Do you remember why? Why the divergence is an N form? Exactly, exactly what we were saying before, that is the Lie derivative just acting on an N form will give you an N form. And it makes sense that we're integrating an N form over an N dimensional thing. So we're good with the left hand side. Let's see what happens in the on the right hand side. So we just have what? We have the inner derivation of a volume form, which is the inner derivation of an N form. So if you remember, the inner derivation is degree minus one, so maps N forms to what? To N minus one forms. And this is fine because we're integrating the N minus one form over what? The boundary of this n-dimensional thing is n minus one dimensional. So kind of like check the right-hand side also makes sense. These, like physically, we can think of as giving us the electric field on the boundary. You might think, okay, that's a bit, like if we think of psi as the electric field in electromagnetism or something, as I was trying to say before, then we would actually have the divergence of an electric field in a volume. Then we need something that will give us the electric field on the boundary to integrate over the boundary of the region. And that's exactly what the this inner derivation does for the volume form. Kind of maps the electric field in the volume to the electric field in the boundary. And so for an electric field, we need N components, right? And in fact, an N minus one form, like lives in lambda N minus one, and remember this is an N dimensional space. So lambda N minus one has N like basis elements. You need to specify N coefficients to write down such an element. And this would be the coefficients of the electric field on the boundary, if you want. Even so, you see, even though you think of an electric field as a vector, but if in your mind vector means covector, this is not the case. This has N components, but just because it's an element of the lambda N minus one. So it's a thing with N components, but not because it's a vector. It's an element of lambda N minus one. And this, why does this matter? It, not just because we want this integration to make sense. It also matters in terms of transformation properties. So just don't just value in terms of, okay, it has N components, should be an n-dimensional vector. It's not in this case. But it would still stand for the electric field on the boundary of our region. Is this clear? Actually, that's all. So if you have questions. Okay, so if you do not have questions, thank you, and yeah.